It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we take a look at what a pandemic spike in violent crime has looked like in rural parts of the country. First, agriculture has been a driver of Wisconsin's economy for a long time, but low commodity prices and ongoing trade disputes in the last several years have put a lot of farmers under pressure, in some cases, out of business. A recent report looks at the latest data to see how farmers are making ends meet. It finds that most Wisconsin farm households need a significant source of off-the-farm income to survive. The author of that report joins us now for a look at what this means for rural economies and the future of farming in Wisconsin. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Do you have a farm? Do you or maybe your spouse split time on and off the farm? How important are non-farm sources of income? Maybe a job off the farm? Maybe it's Social Security. Did you leave farming because of some of these pressures? Call it at 800-642-1234. 1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Steve Deller is a UW Extension Community Economic Development Specialist and professor in agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me back.
Well, I want to start with a comment on Facebook. David writes, if one isn't a huge farm, it isn't worth it to farm. And that's a good starting point, I think. The size of Wisconsin farms has really diverged in a lot of ways. Can you tell us what's going on?
It really has. There's been a kind of a hollowing out of the middle of the farm distribution. Kind of your typical, stereotypical, you know, average family farm really doesn't exist anymore. And its farms are either moving towards bigger or they're trying to scale back to cut their costs down. And this is a real challenge for us that study agriculture in Wisconsin is when you do a simple head count of the number of farms out there, the vast majority of farms, over 50% of the farms, are really very, very, very small. And we get into a question is, you know, is this really a farm or not?
Yeah, if we have conversations about the average farm in Wisconsin, that's super misleading, right? Because so many of them are moving toward the extremes of big economy of scale or smaller. What do you want to call it, hobby farm or farming plus other stuff?
That's true. And one of the things that has allowed this transition to smaller scale, perhaps to kind of cut some of the costs a little bit, is this notion of off-farm income. And that's why I wanted to kind of look at that particular question.
Right. Now, talk about what you're trying to find out as you looked at the data about where farm households are getting their money.
Well, historically, a lot of farms have, you know, had off-farm income. Somebody in the farm household, generally the spouse, has worked off-farm, but it's historically been to get access to health care. But that's changed over time. What's happening now is that when you look at the farm enterprise versus or opposed to the farm household or the farm family, the farm household has really almost become 100% dependent upon off-farm income. And what we're seeing is that because the farm family is stable or relatively stable because of that off-farm income, they're able to keep the farm enterprise up and running.
Talk about the kinds of farming we're talking about here, that commodity farming, those huge fields of, say, corn for animal feed or those really big dairy farms. That's one thing. What are these smaller farms doing?
Well, there's a lot of smaller farms that are getting into more specialized crops. This is partially the local foods movement. It's partially the expansion of interest in more specialized foods. So we're seeing the growth in, say, the number of farmers that are, say, growing hops, or the number of farmers, there was tremendous growth in the number of farmers that were growing cranberries, for example. And we're seeing a more diversified agriculture. I grew up in Illinois, and it was basically corn and beans, corn and beans. And if you had a 2,000-acre farm, you were small. Wisconsin agriculture is very different in that it's very diversified. We're still the cheese state. Dairy still dominates, but we're extremely diversified across a range of different types of commodities and different types of crops.
When we start to look at these smaller farms now in particular, you look at what this off-farm income is. What kind of things are we talking about?
Well, in terms of the level of income, if you're looking at farms that have sales, and this is Wisconsin, if you have farms with sales of more than $1 million, you're looking at about 14% of farm household income coming from off the farm. And that's generally tied to that access to health insurance. But when you get to farms that have less than $100,000 in sales, which is the vast majority of Wisconsin farms, you're looking at 102% of income coming from off-farms. Now, how can it be more than 100%? Well, what that's saying is that this off-farm income is actually supplementing the farm. So it's essentially saying that if we want to keep a lot of these quote-unquote family farms operating, we need to ensure that there's stable sources of off-farm income to keep the farm family stable.
Talking to Steve Deller, UW Extension Community Economic Development Specialist, professor in Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison, looking at farm income, farm household income. A new study he writes says a lot of Wisconsin farms rely on income coming from off the farm, an outside job, say, or Social Security. You can join in with your questions, maybe your own personal experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Okay, let's talk policy now, Steve. If I want to help rural Wisconsin, the ways I do that are very different if a farmer's making, a farm household's making all or most of their income directly from the farm versus a lot of it off the farm. What does that mean for things that can help preserve these farms and boost these rural economies?
One of the challenges that we have is that when you're talking, say, at the state level and definitely at the national level, representatives from urban areas tend to dominate, because that's where most of the population is. So you have folks that are talking about rural development that are coming at it from a very urban perspective. And there's this misnomer that rural America and agriculture are synonymous. In many parts of the U.S., that's true. But there's probably more rural areas where agriculture is one piece of the puzzle. Now, with this particular piece of research, what we're saying is that that relationship between the rural community and farming, agriculture, is kind of flipped. So now, rather than those rural communities being dependent upon farming, it's those farms are now dependent on those rural communities.
So what do you do about that? How do you, I mean, it's easy to say we'll subsidize a crop, say, or something like that. Now, if you're flipping it around, what kind of strategies can you use?
Well, the one strategy is, again, to try to help policymakers understand that the nature of rural America and rural Wisconsin is changing. It has changed. And if we want to have a vibrant farming economy, which I think we should, because it's part of our culture, it's part of who we are as a state, we approach it in a different way. We approach it in a sense of looking at employment opportunities off farm. Now, how do we go about promoting economic development in these smaller rural communities? How long have you got? Because we could talk all day on that.
Get started.
The real driver of economic growth, and I'll talk in terms of employment, it's from new business startups. It's from entrepreneurship. And, you know, a lot of the existing businesses, if you look over time and you look at net job growth, existing businesses tend to shed more jobs than they add. So if it wasn't for new job growth or new business formation, entrepreneurship, we would be losing employment left and right historically. This goes back 30 years. Almost every state follows the same pattern. So I think that a lot of what we need to do is start looking at small business development, entrepreneurship, kind of that mom and pop type of business. The one analogy that I use sometimes, it's we have to plant like 100 seeds. And of those 100 seeds, maybe 50 will take root. Of those 50, maybe 20 will actually grow into healthy plants or healthy businesses. Of that 20, maybe 2 will actually become a major employer. We need to kind of nurture those along the way. The problem is that when we plant those 100 seeds, we don't know which 2 are going to become the major employers. So we kind of have to look at a kind of across the board and try to nurture all of these at the same time.
Steve Deller is with us, UW Extension Community Economic Development Specialist, professor in agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. Talking with Steve about the ways that farm families earn their incomes on and off the farm a lot, especially for smaller farms, very common in Wisconsin, rely heavily on off-farm income, jobs and otherwise. Look at what that means for rural communities and for boosting the economy of rural Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a farm, new or maybe an old family farm? Do you work off of that farm, or does your spouse? How much do you depend on that income? Are you looking for this kind of off-farm employment? If you're in a rural community, do you have businesses starting up? Are you starting up a business yourself, maybe in a small town? What would help you do that? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can call in now or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Steve Deller, a community economic development specialist for UW Extension, looking at the ways farmers earn their income in Wisconsin, a lot of it coming from off of the farm, one or maybe both members of a farm family relying in large part on jobs outside the farm, and what it all means for developing economies in rural parts of the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Are we talking about your community? How has, if you're in farming or your family has been, how has that changed over the years? What would help your rural community develop itself? What kind of things would help create new businesses there? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Steve, are there ways that a local community or even the state government can give a nudge to help with that sort of startup, that business startup you're talking about? I assume just waiting around and hoping it might not come along.
That doesn't happen. One of the things that we're looking at, a colleague of mine, Tessa Conroy, has been doing a lot of work on this. And have you ever heard the phrase, it's not what you know, it's who you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really true when you're talking about entrepreneurship and small business development. It's that network of people that you know, that network of people that you can tap into, that you can learn from. That is extremely important. Chambers of Commerce sometimes do that. Business associations sometimes do that. But one of the things that rural communities kind of struggle with is that this kind of independence is something that's held in high regard. Unfortunately, when you're trying to start a business or you're trying to grow a business, that independence can actually be, it can hold you back. So one of the things that a lot of communities are doing is that they're trying to develop stronger networks, stronger opportunities or better opportunities for potential entrepreneurs and small business owners to get together. They're trying to develop mentorship programs where some of the existing, quote-unquote, successful local business owners can kind of provide mentoring services. These are all really kind of, they're not flashy. They're not shiny. They're not the kinds of things that the media tends to pick up on. So it's really very, it's subtle type of work. But when you talk to economic development practitioners in these rural communities, they get the most professional reward when they're seeing local businesses getting together and sharing ideas and connecting and buying from each other and selling to each other. So that kind of networking can be extremely important.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Nate is with us in Madison. Nate, hi.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Professor, I would like you to comment, perhaps in some depth. We keep hearing about the need for broadband, and I'm travel a lot around the state in some of the more remote areas. And I know that you can't even have a sustained cell conversation in some of the more remote areas of the state. How it seems quite evident to me that if we want to have economic, a robust economic development program, that broadband expansion would be one significant piece of that puzzle.
Nate, thanks a lot for the call. Rural broadband, Steve.
I think that's extremely important. Broadband, one of the terms that we use is that it's a necessary condition, but it's not sufficient. Building broadband is not a magic bullet, but one thing that we learned from COVID and people kind of, you know, students having to learn from home, people telecommuting and things like that, is that access to quality, reliable, affordable broadband is extremely important. Now, one of the things that we're looking at right now is the cost of broadband from a consumer's perspective. One of the things that we found when we were looking at Wisconsin broadband a couple of years ago is that there's a real disconnect when it comes to income. Even if broadband is available, oftentimes it's simply too expensive for a lot of households and individuals. And what we're seeing is that it's kind of a further divide in terms of the poverty trap. This is something that we're trying to work on to try to get a better handle on, what does the cost, the subscription cost of broadband? And could there be policies not just to build the infrastructure, but to also make it more affordable for low-income households?
Thanks a lot for that call, Nate. We'll go to Terry now in Lake Geneva. Terry, hi.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, Terry. You're on the air.
We're probably the smallest cheesemaker in the state of Wisconsin that makes cheese from cow's milk. We milk the cows and we make the cheese. And there's a lot of grant programs that the state and the federal government come up with, but they always talk about how supportive they are of small business. But we recently applied for a grant to get a piece of equipment to allow us to pierce cheese so we could make blue cheese, which would expand our product line. We didn't get a grant, but Tolls got a grant. Tolls is a company that does in excess of $100 million a year, and they gave them a small business grant.
When you talk to the Small Business Administration, they define any business with less than 500 employees as small. Mm-hmm. I think when you're talking about rural Wisconsin, that's a big employer. So there's a matter of definition here. I think this goes back to that notion about networking, because when you apply for these grants, there's a lot of paperwork involved. And this is something that's always kind of a yin and yang with federal grants and state grants and whatnot, is that the amount of paperwork can be really burdensome. But this is taxpayers' money. We really kind of have to make sure that we cross all the T's and dot all the I's, because this is taxpayers' money. So there's kind of a give and take there. But one of the things that some of our extension educators are working on is trying to provide a network of expertise, if you will, for folks to kind of fill out and apply for these grants, because there's a trick to it. And once you learn that trick, you can be pretty successful. I think the other thing that you mentioned is that the big firms getting it. It goes back to my comment about, you know, a lot of the stuff that rural communities are doing is not very flashy, not very shiny. Sometimes there's a political motivation to go after these big projects because they're shiny. They get media coverage. And that's something that it's a challenge.
Thanks a lot for that call, Terry. Terry is in the food processing business as well as doing dairy himself. I believe you've told me in the past, Steve, we employ more people in food processing than in agriculture itself. Do you see still the room for growth? Could these be the kinds of businesses we're talking about in these communities, these startups?
That was actually, you're right. I mean, when you look at food processing employs more people and generates more of the economic impact than on-farm. But we could get into this kind of chicken and egg type of discussion. But the other thing is that a lot of the food processing is in urban areas. So when you think about agriculture, including on-farm and food processing, agriculture is an urban phenomenon. But folks don't. One of the things, though, I think that's really important here is that with a lot of these smaller farms and the movement towards more local foods, I use that term very generically, is this notion of value added, of actually taking your product and trying to add some value to it and capturing some of that money. A number of local businesses, local farmers are trying to move in that direction. So we're almost seeing agriculture, again, bifurcate into large commodity. They're selling into the commodity market, yellow cheese number two, or they're moving into these product markets where you can actually kind of market it and try to make a little bit of money off of that. Now, that's a form of entrepreneurship, and how can we help nurture that?
Right, and briefly, if I'm barely making ends meet with my farm, can I afford, say, the equipment to do that value added?
No, that's where off-farm income comes into play, because what off-farm income does is that it stabilizes the farm family, the farm household, and allows the farm to maybe take a few risks that normally it wouldn't do because the family is stable.
Steve, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Steve Deller, Community Economic Development Specialist and Professor in Agricultural and Applied Economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We talked with Steve about farm households in Wisconsin and the importance of off-farm sources of income. Very important, especially to the many smaller farms in the state, and what it all means for development, economic development in rural parts of the state. Still time for you to share your story, by the way. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up after the news, there is an increase in violent crime in the U.S. starting in 2020. Cities get a lot of the attention, but rural areas have also seen a significant increase. We'll find out what's driving that trend. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, monkeypox is in the news with new cases around the country. A Wisconsin infectious disease expert tells us what it is, how it's treated, and what concerns the disease is raising. Now, violent crime spiked during the pandemic. Homicides in cities went up 30% in 2020, according to CDC data. But this isn't just a problem in cities. It extends to rural parts of the country as well. In 2020, homicide rates in rural America spiked a similar amount, 25%. That's the biggest increase since the CDC started tracking those numbers two decades ago. Our next guest looked at crime in rural communities and the challenges that rural police departments are facing. Zusha Ellenson is a U.S. News reporter for The Wall Street Journal who focuses on crime and guns. Zusha, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Dan Frost is an enterprise reporter for The Wall Street Journal who writes often about crime in the U.S. He's a graduate, by the way, of Beloit College. Dan, welcome back to Wisconsin.
I appreciate it.
Dan, the two of you and a colleague looked at rural homicide around the country. How is the nature of this problem different in rural areas, maybe, than what we're seeing in urban parts of the country?
Well, it's a good question. In urban areas, over the past few years, we've seen sort of an acceleration of the classic gang and drug related crime fueled by gun violence. But in rural areas, it's much harder to pinpoint why we've seen homicides increase. You don't have sort of the traditional organized gangs jockeying for turf. You don't have other sort of criminal enterprises the same way that you do in cities. And so what we found was that sort of the traditional community ties and rituals that have bound small communities and rural towns together for many years were really overturned during the pandemic. And in some form or fashion, that contributed to the rise in homicides in these areas.
And Zusha, rural law enforcement doesn't always have resources that police and cities have, very small staffs. What did you find looking at how police departments are dealing with these increases in homicides?
Yeah, I mean, this was a really troubling time for these little police departments and sheriff's offices across the West and in the South and in these small towns. A lot of them cover counties that are as big as states like Connecticut with a handful of deputies. So they're driving an hour or more to crime scenes. They can't send officers to a particular problem area to patrol. They just have too much space like they can do in cities. So they're really struggling to deal with this surge in violence. They've asked for more deputies. Prosecutors are overwhelmed with cases as well. They're asking for more line prosecutors. It's kind of an intractable problem. Although they're starting to see homicides go down in some areas, and in some areas they're continuing to climb.
Dan, in that piece actually led us to give you a call, you and your colleagues looked at you know, some particular towns and got firsthand reports from sheriffs and community members and others. How did they talk about this? It seemed, first of all, they were very surprised to see this increase.
Yeah, I mean, you're dealing with areas that typically would see maybe one homicide a year. Oftentimes they'd go several years without seeing a homicide, and then suddenly they're seeing five, six, seven, you know, in double digits. And so I think it was not only quite shocking to community members, law enforcement, prosecutors who were not used to investigating this number of homicides, if any homicides at all, but also the level of violence that they were seeing. It wasn't something that they had seen before. It was an extreme level of violence. And, one of the prosecutors that we spoke to from rural Arkansas basically made it seem like in her area that everyone had essentially just sort of lost their minds during COVID. And so pretty much everybody to a T we spoke to in these rural communities were stunned at not only the number of homicides they were seeing, but the level of violence they were seeing as well.
And Zusha, it occurs to me that, you know, for a city is going to have one or more newspapers. It's going to have local TV stations, lots of maybe of news radio, too. These smaller communities we're talking about may not have that local media outlet. Is that keeping this kind of an invisible problem in the country in some ways?
Yeah, I mean, as we set out to investigate this, we looked at the federal data, and that's really what led us to this story. This is really an untold story about violence in America. I mean, we've thought of rural areas as the safest place in America for decades, right? That's the place where you go if you want to get away from the big cities. That's the place where you know your neighbors, where you can keep your doors unlocked, where you can keep your keys in your cars. But what we've seen in doing these stories is that, behavior is changing in these small communities after the rise in violence. A lot of people said, as cliche as it sounds, that they've locked their doors for the first time. We talked to people who lived in the mountain, these mountainous region in Montana, these, very strong, tough guys who, work on ranches, construction workers. And they said, I've never been afraid in my life before. And now I'm locking my front door.
We're talking to Zusha Ellenson and Dan Frosch from The Wall Street Journal. They looked into an increase in crime and violent crime in rural parts of the United States during the pandemic. Rates jumped there almost as much as in urban areas. Dan, is there, because we're dealing with lots of different communities, lots of different crimes, is there a common type of situation that leads to homicide? Is it a domestic violence or domestic dispute, or is it hard to say there's a most common type?
I don't know if there was necessarily a most common type, but we did notice sort of several trends. We noticed that disputes between neighbors or acquaintances or people who had some sort of interactions with each other spiraled quickly into violence in these areas. One of the cases we highlighted was a dispute over lawn mowing, which led to a homicide. Another was a sort of disagreement happening at a bar. There was just sort of a randomness to some of these homicides that I think was particularly striking. As I mentioned earlier, it wasn't sort of the traditional tit for tat shootings that you see in urban areas. involving drugs or gang activity. There was really sort of an acceleration of emotions that fueled the violence in these areas that I think was sort of an underlying current that we noticed in all the communities we profiled.
And Zuso, in the homicides we're talking about in rural areas, how common, how much of this was gun violence in particular?
Yeah, so a lot of it was gun violence, but we were also surprised to find that especially in a lot of these domestic violence cases, there was a lot of strangulation, stabbings, and these were real crimes of, you know, people call them crimes of passion, people's anger boiling over and using whatever they had there with them to kill the person. So, you know, there was a lot of gun violence, but there was also, I think, more than we expected, other means used.
Dan, are we seeing any kind of response to this, any sort of targeted efforts from federal, state, or local authorities for that matter?
You're seeing law enforcement in rural areas interested and trying to beef up their ranks. I mean, all over the country, we've seen sort of an exodus of officers from police departments, large and small. So it's already a challenge. But some of these rural departments, which are already understaffed and as Zuso pointed out, having to police these large swaths of the country, are recognizing that they may need more officers. So they're trying to hire more. They're also trying to sort of increase their crime forensics capabilities as a way of investigating some of these crimes. But to be honest with you, it's, you know, as one of the sheriffs who I spoke to pointed out, these aren't crimes that can necessarily be prevented in a way that crimes in cities can potentially, where you can sort of focus on a particular area that's high crime and deploy resources to it. Because of the randomness of the violence that these rural areas were seeing, it's really much more reactive on the part of these small rural law enforcement agencies. So it's a tough problem they have on their hands.
And Zuso, as we wrapped up earlier, you mentioned that some of the communities we're talking about in rural areas are seeing this trend reverse some. What are you watching for in the months to come to see if that tends to be more of a trend in more of rural America?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. We're going to be looking for reports from local sheriffs. We're going to be looking at CDC data coming out. We're going to be looking at FBI data coming out to see if the homicides go down and violent crime goes down. Anecdotally, what we've seen is that in some places it started to ease as sort of the stress and the attendant problems of the pandemic recede. But in some places it's continued. So it's going to be fascinating to see what happens.
We'll leave it there, Zuso. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, guys.
And Dan,
thanks for having us.
Thanks for being with us. Yeah. Zuso Allinson is a U.S. News reporter for The Wall Street Journal who focuses on gun and crimes. And Dan Frosch is an enterprise reporter at The Journal who writes about crime in the U.S. They talked to us about a spike in violent crime during the pandemic in rural America. Coming up, a Wisconsin infectious disease expert tells us what's going on with monkeypox in the United States. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a neuroscientist tells us about the myth of a normal brain, what makes everyone's brain different, and how to better understand our own minds. Now, the World Health Organization declared monkeypox a global health emergency on July 23rd. The U.S. is approaching 6,000 total cases, 18 of those detected in Wisconsin. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Dr. Jonathan Tempty is the Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health with expertise in vaccines and immunization policy. He's a professor in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at UW-Madison. Dr. Tempty, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you so much, Rob. It's a pleasure to be with you again, especially not talking about COVID.
Right. A change of pace for us here, Dr. Tempty. Now, tell us a little bit about monkeypox. It's caused, I understand, by a virus. Tell us a little bit about this disease.
Well, this is a virus that is closely related to smallpox and some of the other contagious diseases out there. This particular disease was first isolated back in 1958 and was originally found in a colony of research monkeys, so hence the name monkeypox. In general, though, this is one that has typically been spread by other animals to humans. And in fact, back in 2003, Wisconsin had a small outbreak that was caused primarily by spread from, I believe, prairie dogs to humans. And Wisconsin had more cases than any other state at that time. But I hate to say this, but currently we're up to 22 cases in Wisconsin, and that surpasses what we had back in 2003.
Now, you say smallpox, which I think of as one of the most horrific diseases in human history. Monkeypox, not that bad?
Not that bad. Unfortunately, in this current outbreak, there have now been some deaths reported. And in Africa, where this disease is more common and what we call endemic, the rate of death is somewhere between 1% and 6% of cases. But you have to keep in mind that those are situations where there are many more children exposed.
So tell us a little bit about how we might recognize a case of smallpox. I'm sorry, of monkeypox.
Well, yeah, hopefully we keep it with monkeypox,
right, yes.
Here. That typically the way we recognize this is through fairly obvious skin lesions. These tend to be larger, somewhat rubbery in feel. They start out as a spot. They turn into a lump, turn into what we call a vesicle or a fluid-filled lesion. These will eventually either burst or resolve, get replaced by a scab. The scab will come off and be replaced by normal skin. And this might take anywhere from 3 to 4 weeks to go through that. Unfortunately, early on, the first symptoms are very, very, you know, non-definitive. They tend to be fever, fatigue, sore muscles, sore back, and so on. But typically, about anywhere from a day to 3 days after these initial symptoms, we tend to see this rash coming on.
Now, how contagious is monkeypox?
Well, I tend to tell people that if you're a human being with skin and mucous membranes, there's a possibility of becoming infected. But it's not highly contagious. We know from some studies that the rate of transmission within a household tends to be less than 10%. And this compares to things like COVID, which might be as high as 40 to 70% transmissibility within a household. So the good news is it's not as transmissible, but it is transmissible. What it takes, though, basically is skin-to-skin contact. And there's some evidence emerging that there is, you know, the potential for sexual transmission as well.
Talking to Dr. Jonathan Tempty with UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the disease monkeypox, some cases now here in Wisconsin and around the U.S. Dr. Tempty, vaccines, what kind of vaccine options are out there? Are they available?
Absolutely. And the good news is there are two vaccines that are already licensed by the FDA. They were both developed primarily for a smallpox response. And fortunately, we haven't had that situation at all. But because they are in the same family, they also appear to cover for monkeypox as well. One is called ACAM2000, which is a live virus vaccine, requires one dose. The other is Jynneos, and it is a vaccine that is a live virus but does not replicate or reproduce in you. And that one requires two doses about 28 days apart. But both of these are licensed. They are available but only in limited supplies. And so these aren't available for anybody who wants them. We tend to provide them to people who are at high risk or have had exposure.
Who is at high risk? Who might be first in line for that kind of vaccine?
Well, currently the state of Wisconsin has three criteria. First, people who have a sexual partner who has been diagnosed with monkeypox in the last 14 days. The second group are people who have attended an event where there was known monkeypox exposure. And the third would be for individuals who are gay, bisexual, transgender, or men who have sex with men and have had multiple partners in the last 14 days. And I bring this up because this is a vaccine. If we provide it within 4 days of exposure, you can actually prevent the monkeypox. So this is something we call post-exposure prophylaxis. It also is something that people in the future can be vaccinated against, you know, for prevention. One of the other factors out there, and I just say this with a little trepidation, but for those of us who are age 55 and older, we probably got the smallpox vaccine as children. You can check by looking for the donut-shaped scar on your upper arm. And there probably is some protection for some of us older folks out there who have previously received the smallpox vaccine.
Now, when COVID-19 came about, you know, it was a coronavirus. It was related to diseases we had seen before, but basically this is a first time thing for humans. Monkeypox is different, right? This is a new outbreak of a disease we've known about for some time.
Yeah, as I mentioned before, we've known about this disease since 1958, so almost 65 years. And it has largely been confined in two areas of Africa. There is a Central Africa and a Western Africa strain of this virus. But the concern right now is it has jumped out of the traditional area and has really exploded across the globe right now. There are over 80 countries that have cases and almost 24,000 known cases out there across the world. And because of this, the World Health Organization has labeled this a public health emergency of international concern.
What about treatment? Are there available, I don't know, antiviral medications that that can reduce the damage of this illness?
Well, there are antiviral agents that are effective against some of the cousins of this virus. We don't have anything that is officially labeled or indicated for monkeypox, but there are agents out there that we think will be helpful. And these, again, are aimed particularly at people who are at high risk for bad outcomes, individuals with immunosuppression or other reasons that a skin infection could really cause a lot of harm.
For parents, Dr. Tempty, who might be watchful for chicken pox for their kids, is there an easy way to tell the difference and say, oh yeah, get to the doctor sooner than later?
Well, I think the main thing is, fortunately, chicken pox has been rendered a relatively rare disease in the United States because of very, very effective vaccines that we give in childhood. And so chickenpox in my career has gone from a very, very common illness to one which is now reportable to the state when we see it, because it is relatively rare. But chickenpox tends to be much smaller lesions. I tend to tell people that they're the size of a, you know, corn kernel or less in size. The monkeypox tends to be a little bit larger than that. More anywhere from that size up to a dime or quarter size. And at this point in time, we're seeing most of the cases of monkeypox in adults. Whereas there have been a couple cases reported in children, most of the cases are in adults.
Dr. Tempty, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
And thank you so much, helping to get the word out.
That's Dr. Jonathan Tempty, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at UW's School of Medicine and Public Health, also professor in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at UW-Madison. He joined us today for a look at monkeypox, declared a global health emergency now, as we heard, by the World Health Organization. We're watching numbers in Wisconsin and around the country. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, a look at board games and the people who play them. This with two Wisconsin game designers. So that's my kind of conversation. You can join in. Maybe I will too. And you can get started right now. Email ideas@wpr.org. Do you have a favorite board game to play with family, with friends? with enemies? Email ideas@wpr.org with your board game favorites. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Sometimes after reading a lot of words and saying a lot of words in my life, I still learn new things about words. Here's one, the word chicane. That's C-H-I-C-A-N-E. Now, this came up because my daughter has been calling the split between I-90 and I-94 by Toma a chicane. It isn't, really. She watches Formula One. She knows it's actually a serious curve in a road often used in racing. But I learned something new when I looked it up. There's an older meaning from card games, where a chicane is an absence of trump cards in your hand of cards. Now, and that's bad, by the way, if you don't play these games. You want those cards. I play Pinochle a lot. I play online with my parents every week. Sad to say, with my luck, I often have what I now know is a chicane. And by the way, if I figure out how to hack into the card game server and give myself better cards, I would be engaging in a related word, chicanery. Lots of twists and turns. This is Central Time.